order. Welcome. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 783. I'll ask Jan to lead us through the new Dash 6 amendments.
Would you like to do it, Mr. Chairman, page by page, or just hit the highlights?
Let's just hit the highlights, please.
I second that.
Members of the committee, you should have before you the Dash 6 amendments. We tried to get them to your office earlier, but we also handed them out just before the meeting. These are from AOI, I believe. They worked with some parties to come up with this language, and they're here if you have any questions on it. Some of the high points include specifying that eligible post-secondary course means a non-sectarian course. Also, it clarifies that a post-secondary institution must only award college credit if the course is considered to be a college-level course by the institution. It requires that payment agreements between the district and the post-secondary institution for a non-tuition course or non-credit course pay the actual costs associated with the student attending the institution. It deletes the prohibition that post-secondary institutions may not deny admission of students based on a disability. It also deletes the requirement that at a post-secondary institution there be at least one licensed special ed provider. It adds a provision that if more students wish to participate in the program than there is room, that the school district will give priority to at-risk students and that at-risk would be defined by the district. And it does contain some language stating that if existing programs are ongoing and in place, they may be continued. So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Steele.
Thank you. So, on the first part of this, to say that it's an eligible post-secondary course means a non-sectarian course, it still means that the student could use the K-12 funding and to go to a private institution. That's my understanding.
Okay.
That if a college such as Willamette is affiliated with a particular religion, as long as the class wasn't a religious class, they could get credit.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Are we in hearing or work session?
We're in a work session, but yeah. We have a number of people who signed up and didn't get to testify before. We're going to call them up. And so, in a sense, we're continuing our hearing.
Okay.
But this is a work session. And I would invite Andrea Meyer and Lori Wimmer.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. And though the bulk of our testimony with respect to the bill has already been delivered in the first hearing by our president, I did want to respond to you, and you're getting in writing a copy of our legal response to the LC opinion around the constitutional questions we raised. We are very strongly of the opinion there are significant constitutional issues still, and if you have a chance to read the opinion, you'll see why. And we wanted to make sure that that opinion, which begged a response, did in fact receive one. Secondly, as you may know, the Oregon Education Association represents about 50% of the community college faculty in Oregon, and the Dash 6 amendments have not met our needs with respect to their interests, from what we can tell. And so we remain opposed to the bill with respect to the issues of capacity and financial ability that the bill brings forward. And finally, we also believe that that we continue to have problems with the amendments in the Dash 6 as well, because it raises new questions about funding developmental programs with what may be a blank check and basically takes away the value of having the financial caps. And with that, I'll hand it over to Andrea for the chip question.
Good afternoon, Chair Starr. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Meyer. I'm the legislative director and counsel for the ACLU of Oregon. and I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 783. I think at this time, a longer version of my legal analysis in response to the LC opinion on this bill is being handed out to the committee. Our concern is specifically related to what Senator Castillo mentioned a moment ago, which in even the most current draft refers to the eligible post-secondary institutions as ones that could be religious institutions and does not limit it just to public institutions. In taking the time to review Legislative Council's opinion, which was requested by Senator Gordley, LC concluded that that provision would not violate Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution, which prohibits the use of taxpayer money for religious institutions. I respectfully, pretty adamantly disagree with how LC arrived at the result they did. And briefly, LC relies upon a 25-year-old case, Eugene Sand and Gravel versus City of Eugene, which was a rather controversial and divided 4-3 opinion before the Oregon Supreme Court that upheld the Skinner Butte Cross on public property. It's actually the second case, the original case decided under an analysis of both Oregon and federal constitution, held that it was unconstitutional. Voters were asked to change the intent of the cross so that it was a Veterans War Memorial, and the proponents of the cross went back to court arguing a material change in circumstances. In the Oregon Supreme Court, ignored any constitutional analysis and simply adopted the Lemon test articulated by the federal court, U.S. Supreme Court, in Lemon v. Kurtzman, and analyzed it under Lemon and federal case law. Interestingly enough, as a footnote, subsequent to that decision, the cross in a Ninth Circuit case was actually held unconstitutional under the same federal Lemon test analysis in separation of church and state. I believe that was 1996. It is our position that Eugene Sand and Gravel and its reliance on Lemon is not good law under Oregon courts today. Okay. And the reason are a number of points. In the last 20 years, the Oregon Constitution, the Oregon courts have articulated and examined the Oregon Constitution distinctly from the federal. And in fact, in recent decisions, Stranahan versus Fred Meyer and other cases, the court has said, in fact, that you must look at the Oregon Constitution separately and distinctly. And you look at the specific wording of the state constitutional provision, you look at the historic context that led to its creation, and any case law construing it. And that case law is Oregon case law. The text, as you know, in Article 1, Section 5, is uniquely different than the First Amendment. And in fact, there are a number of religious provisions in the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And they provide both a strict separation of church and state as well as a broad inclusion of religious freedoms. Now, I want to go back and talk about Dickman because that was a case that LC relied upon as suggesting, in fact, that this would be unconstitutional, but then the LC suggested that Dickman is not good law anymore, and that's just simply inaccurate. In Dickman, the Oregon Supreme Court held that a school district could not supply free textbooks to pupils enrolled at a local parochial school maintained and operated by the Catholic Church without violating Article 1, Section 5. It was the use of taxpayer money for the benefit of students who then went on to a private religious school. Dickman rejected any application of federal case law and federal constitutional standard. And the court said it is not only within the power of the state courts in Oregon, it is their duty to decide whether the state constitution has been violated. Our views on the policy or interpretation of a particular constitutional provision do not always coincide with those of the Supreme Court of the United States. Subsequent to Dickman came Eugene Sand and Gravel, which I've already mentioned was sort of a blip and an aberration. After Eugene Sand and Gravel in the 1980s, the Oregon Supreme Court renewed its intentions stated in Dickman, namely to construe the Oregon Bill of Rights independent of federal constitutional construction. And they did that in a wide variety of provisions in the Oregon Constitution, including the First Amendment equivalence, Articles 1, Sections 2, 3, and 5. And the court has stated in subsequent decisions that for more than a decade, this court has independently construed the provisions of the Oregon Constitution without being controlled by the treatment given to parallel provisions of the federal Constitution by the Supreme Court of the United States. And the court in that decision, and that was State ex-rel juvenile department Z. Rogers, a 1992 decision. And again, Eugene Sand and Gravel was a 1970s or 69 decision. That case, the court recognized that this had not always been the case in Oregon, that they had sometimes gone what's referred to as lockstep with the federal constitution, but now they give an independent analysis of the Oregon constitution, and they don't necessarily comply with what the U.S. Supreme Court has said on similar provisions. In 1985, the Oregon Supreme Court specifically abandoned deference to the United States Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment, the religious provisions, and the court stated, "The Court of Appeals held that a statutory distinction between church-supported and independent religious schools constitutes an establishment of religion forbidden by the First Amendment. And it stated, in view of our conclusion with respect to the federal constitution, we need not, and we do not, consider the Oregon Constitution." The Oregon Supreme Court went on, "That approach departed from the judicial responsibility to determine its own law before deciding whether the state falls short of federal constitutional standards." And it reversed the Court of Appeals. And there have been subsequent cases. That was Salem College, there's Smith versus Employment Division, and in Cooper versus Eugene School District in 1986. The court, and I want to quote, because the court in that case talked about not just the fact that you don't go lockstep with the federal constitution, but it articulated the vision of the Oregon Constitution and the religious provisions that are distinctly and uniquely different and what we are very proud of here in Oregon. And the court stated, "The religion clauses of the Oregon Bill of Rights, Article 1, Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, are more than a code. They are specifications of a larger vision of freedom for a diversity of religious beliefs and modes of worship, and freedom from state-supported official faith or modes of worship. Accumulation of guarantees more numerous and more concrete than the opening clause of the First Amendment reinforces the significance of the separate guarantees." Now, Elsie is correct that there is exactly one opinion in the Court of Appeals, not the Oregon Supreme Court, that cited the Lemon Test enunciated in Eugene Sand and Gravel. And that was Hay versus David Douglas School District. What Elsie omits is, in fact, that the Supreme Court reversed that decision for lack of judiciability. However, Hay can still be understood in its context of its time. It was decided well at the very beginning of what I've articulated is a separate and distinct standard that the Oregon courts now apply. It was done before that. It ignored the Oregon Constitution. It never analyzed the Oregon Constitution. And it ignored, actually, inappropriately, I believe, a Supreme Court decision that had come down a year before, again saying, we look at the Oregon Constitution, we do not follow the federal Constitution. Finally, so where does that leave us? If we don't look at the federal constitution, what do we do? And as I mentioned earlier, what the courts have instructed that we do in analyzing those provisions is we look at the historical context of the text and the case law. I've discussed some of the case law, but I just want to reflect back on what the historical context of this provision of the Oregon Constitution and why, indeed, Oregon founders articulated such a strong separation of church and state. And the intent of the framers is well documented in Charles Carey's edited version of the Oregon Constitution and Proceedings and Debates of the Constitutional Convention of 1857. And that is the only text we have which provides an account of the Constitutional Convention of 1857. And in there, the founders spent a good deal of time discussing Article 1, Section 5, and the chairman of the Bill of Rights Committee of the Oregon Convention, Lafayette Grover, stated this about Article 1, Section 5, the issue before you today. "It is true that this Constitution goes a step farther than other constitutions on this subject, but if that step is in the right direction and consistent with the proper development of our institutions, I see no weight in the objection that it is new. Let us take a step further and declare a complete divorce of church and state." So the founders made it very clear, and where the courts are left in the last 20 years of analyzing Oregon case and Oregon constitutional law is not under Eugene Sand and Gravel, and it is not under Lemon. It is under the uniqueness of the Oregon Constitution, taking into account the text, the historical context, and the case law, which I've already discussed. And in light of that, we think that there is simply no question that Senate Bill 783, as written, to include religious institutions would violate Article 1, Section 5. As one aside, I will note that in the Elsie opinion, they discuss the fact that there are scholarship programs and that there is no Court of Appeals decision on the scholarship programs. It is our understanding from our historical recollection at the ACLU of Oregon that we, in fact, sued over this in the 1980s. And the case was settled when private institutions which were not religious and others involved decided to encourage the religious institutions from opting out or being out of that program. And so if there is, in fact, there are, in fact, religious institutions which are receiving the scholarship funds under the statute side by LC, we simply maintain that that, in addition, is unconstitutional, and we would pursue that. Thank you. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ozzie Rose and John Marshall. And Bratton, were you planning?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ozzie Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And I'm here to encourage you not to pass Senate Bill 783. We are supportive of expanding options for at-risk kids and help more kids be successful, all kids successful. We do not think the issue is as simple as allowing students to use K-12 budget resources to attend post-secondary school. Having said that, we acknowledge that much work has gone on in the work group to create a bill that is acceptable to all the stakeholders, and our thanks to Senator Gordley, who orchestrated those work groups and said at the start of these hearings that a serious effort was made by all parties, and it was recognized that all parties might not get to the same place. And unfortunately, we're not there. Our thoughts we would like you to consider. Why should the K-12 budget resources be shifted to paying for post-secondary education expenses for some students at the expense of others in this environment? Over the years, we have added responsibilities to school budget without recognizing the shift in resources required to meet those responsibilities. Lunch programs, breakfast programs, nurses, immunization control, medical needs, etc. There are a lot of things we do, and they're all good things, need to be done. And we've added them, but we seldom add them and add the appropriate resources. And this is another item to be added to the K-12 budget. The proposal before you adds post-secondary costs to the list of new responsibilities assigned to the K-12 budget. Should you do that at this time? We think not. This proposal means 5 teachers to Beaverton, probably 4.5 teachers to Salem, 3 or 3.5 to Hillsboro. We don't believe that the end result of focusing, which is, this is turned from a bill that looked like something in another state to one that's trying to focus on people at risk, and we don't think the focus will wind up there. My own experience I offer to you as an illustration why we think this is bad policy. Those of you who have been around here know a little bit about me, and I talk a lot about my family. My youngest son is a junior at Sprague. He needs one class to graduate, and he has to take English next year. Other than that, he has all his work completed. Under 783, he will be able to attend Willamette or Chemeketa or Western or even drive to Eugene and go to a really good school.
About Corvallis.
You'll have time. Or drive right by Corvallis, right. Mm. And take advantage of this this position. I don't know the details of it, but my family income is probably in the top 10% in our state. I'm 65, so I'm drawing Social Security. My wife is drawing Social Security, and my son is drawing Social Security. And why should we send him to school, use K-12 resources to do that, while his classmates at Sprague are left in overcrowded classrooms? This is the fundamental problem for us on the bill. This is an additional cost to K-12 programs that we don't think is appropriate at this time, and we ask you to consider that. One technical issue with the Dash 6 amendments, there is a cap in the bill that uses, it's on page 10, section 17, that caps the number of hours that a school would have to fund, and that's where you get to how many teachers you may or may not be funding for. But the addition of the non-tuition, non-credit courses, it just states that we will pay all their costs up to 90% of the average ADM, which would be about $4,200, I think, or excuse me, about $4,700. I don't think that connects with that cap. I'm not sure. But if you move forward with this, I think you should look into this. Does that, in fact, stay under the cap, or is it connected? I don't think it is. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
Also, tell me again about your son. He needs only one more credit to graduate, so he finished up this year, and he's got to go to school one more year for one credit?
Yes, Senator Fisher, Mr. Chair, my son, we have an 8-period day at Sprague, and we also have early bird. My son's a pretty good student and a hard worker, and he has taken lots of courses. He will not go to college. He'll stay. There are a lot of courses left at Sprague that he can take, but he doesn't have to. There are still advanced math courses. There's a lot he can do at Sprague, and he will, and he'll be an active participant. But my point is that if I chose to try to get his first year of college paid for, I could tell him, no, don't do that. Take the course you need and go to Temecula or WASC or somewhere and get it. That's my point. There's not a lack of things to do at Sprague, if that's where you're headed. There's plenty to do at Sprague. He just doesn't need to do all of them because he's done so much already.
Mr. Chairman,
further questions?
It brings up a personal situation that I had happen to me. I wasn't told that I was fast-tracking years ago in high school. I wound up and needed an eighth of a credit because I got in a fight with a band teacher and dropped band. That eighth of a credit caused me to have to go another year to high school. Now, nobody even told me that that situation existed at that time, so, and we're in a long time, but I was in a position myself where I was needing to get out of the high school situation for a lot of reasons, and I wound up then having to go on to college and drop back and pick up two high school courses because it made me take two complete subjects, because if I went as a four-year graduate, I had to have two more credits, and yet to give me a three-year graduate, I only needed an eighth of a credit. And this kind of stuff, as I look back on it, makes no sense to somebody that's thinking there. Now, again, I don't know what your son's situation is. If he's that good of a student, he's progressing on there. I'm not sure why I would want to see him stay in high school another year at all. And why, if he's that close, a high school would have to need to claim on him and get all this money from his having to be the captive student there for another year. But otherwise, you know, he may not be maturely ready to proceed on at a higher level socially and for reasons that you may have as a family, and I respect that. But it seems pretty dumb to me for us to design an education system that would require him to stay there one more year in high school for one stinking credit. And he ought to be propelled, you know, basically are looking for it. If he's in an interest of going on, he ought to be spending that year in college and having just one more year of productive life after he gets out of school rather than one more year of sitting on his duff someplace just for one more credit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, in his senior year at Sprague, he'll take his fourth year of Japanese. He'll take his fourth year of language. He'll take his fourth year of advanced math. He'll take some physical education. He'll take speech. He will take another year of social sciences. There's plenty to do for him to do and help him grow and be a better student.
And he can't get that at college?
He may or may not get that in college. Depends on what you would pursue. But my point is that I don't think that if he went to college, that the K-12 budget ought to be expanded to start paying for those kids to go to college. That's my issue.
Well, should the K-12 program be awarded the whole tuition out of the taxpayer's pocket just so he can enjoy a few advanced classes that he might get some other way? That's what I'm trying to say.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, he's in this position because he went to school longer than other kids, took an extra period every day. and he's here because he worked hard and took advantage of all the options that are there.
Mr. Chair, I guess that I'm just saying here, he's basically got the 4 years criteria, and in 3 years, at his desire, how much does a taxpayer owe?
He's met the minimum requirement. Yeah. Minimum requirements, except for a fourth year of English.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Before I begin my testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 783, I'd also like to extend our appreciation to Senator Gordley and her work in bringing a diverse group of folks into a room. While there was often a disagreement, thanks to her tutelage of the group, there we were never disagreeable. The organization that I represent, the elected officials of Oregon's 198 school districts, support options. There's a premise underlying public education today that all students can learn, but they learn at different rates and levels, and they don't all learn in the regular classroom environment. So a number of options have been created, and we've supported those. Two sessions ago, we supported an expansion of Oregon's alternative education statutes to allow students alternative education options that not only met their needs, but also met their interests. 2 years ago, we supported Oregon's charter school law, which we believe is one of the best laws relating to charter schools in the country. So we've supported options. The testimony that you've received on this bill, you heard from 7 school districts. And the representatives from each of those school districts talked about the variety of options they currently create for students to earn concurrent college and high school credit while still in high school. According to data from the Department of Education, 22,000 students in Oregon, high school students today, are currently earning concurrent high school and college credit. So the structure is in place to allow school districts to create options. And we believe those options are best that are created locally in partnership with the school district and their community college, in partnership with the school district and their state university, in partnership with a school district and a private university, be it Willamette here in Salem, be it George Fox, Pacific, and so forth. Consistent in the development of all those programs has been the goal of school boards to strike a balance. That is a balance between creating options for students while maintaining some semblance of resources for students that remain in the regular school program and maybe choose to not take advantage of those options. Some issues inside 783 we don't believe have been resolved, and I'd like to mention a couple of those. Senate Bill 783 proposes a mandate. Let's not call it what it isn't. It's a mandate. It imposes a program without the concomitant funding. I'd like for you to think about some of the provisions of Senate Bill 783 as well as the amendments regarding to special education, that is, education for students with disabilities. School districts are under the behemoth of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which creates a plethora of requirements on school districts to assure that the needs of students with disabilities are met. Under the provisions of 783, the long arm of the federal government and the Individuals with Disabilities Act reaches into the higher education institution. And I would ask you to take a look at page 9 and go through the requirements that will fall on of the Dash 6 amendments. Of the requirements that will ultimately fall on institutions of higher education. And there's another interesting provision of the Dash 6 amendments, and that is it removes the requirement that prohibits higher education institutions from discriminating based on disability. Now, whether or not that's covered elsewhere or not, I don't know, but I think that's a glaring distinction or difference between the earlier amendments and what I noticed in the Dash 6. Regarding the issue of the kids that choose not to take advantage of these options, in earlier versions, there was a provision that students may not take higher education courses that were currently offered at the high school. Many courses, particularly those that may earn a student college credit, advanced placement, and so forth, there's generally a limited number of students. If a handful of students under this program are available to leave that particular program in high school, there may not be enough students left to maintain that that program, be it an advanced math, science, and so forth. So the concern is, what about the kids that choose not to take advantage of these options? What about the kids that are left behind? Under both our expanded alternative education law as well as charter schools, there's some authority of the local school district to make determinations. There is no such authority inside Senate Bill 783. I'm not suggesting to you that we build a fence, but what I am suggesting is that there be some kind of revolving door. If the intent of Senate Bill 783 is to get to students with the greatest risk of dropping out of school, there should be some program in place to try to engage those students in their learning. And I would submit to you that many of the students that are currently dropping out are not engaged. And if there's nothing in, and although the bill suggests an educational plan, there's nothing beyond that that requires the school district to look at a student, whether or not they would benefit from an expanded option program, or whether they even have the potential for success. Again, our bottom line is the ability to strike a balance. Much work has been done by Senator Farioli and his revenue committee on trying to focus on assisting small school districts, particularly small school districts with small high schools. Creating a drain of this sort and giving the ability of some students to leave and take their some high school classes at a college, we think creates an additional burden on the students that are left and the ability of those school districts to maintain any kind of a comprehensive program. Our bottom line has always been, how do we strike the balance? It's, I think, not coincidental that right now school boards all over the state are attempting to balance their budgets. They're attempting to sort of guess what the legislature might do in terms of a state school fund appropriation and put together programs that they think best meet the needs of all their students. And in our view, Senate Bill 783, its mandate and its drain on limited, what will certainly be limited school district resources, is inadvisable, and we would encourage you to reject it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm finished, and I'd be pleased to respond to questions.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I would like to acknowledge, I don't know that she's planning to come up and speak at all today, but I want to acknowledge a Portland Public School Board member, someone I respect a great deal and is just doing an outstanding job on the board and under really tough circumstances right now, given our budget shortfall. I'm speaking of Carla Wenzel. And Carla, if you would just stand and be acknowledged. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gurdley. Mr. Kearns.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grant and Kearns, Director of Criminal Relations for the Oregon University System. Thank you for the opportunity. I won't repeat any of my earlier testimony on the bill, but direct my comments to the Sixth Amendment. I peruse them and find that they are acceptable to the Oregon University system and do what is required for us to participate. Relative to accepting an eligible student, our responsibility to that student, our responsibilities to the sending school district, the courses that they may engage in, the use of credit, in both the accepting higher education institution, I would go farther than that and say for the record that any credits earned at any of the Oregon University System campuses will be accepted at any other campus of the Oregon University System if they're earned under this program. We understand the limitation on the 2 years for a junior and a 1 year for a senior. And their participation on one of our campuses. So virtually everything that we had been concerned about is the bill went through its very long and winding road to arrive here today. The university system sees that the minimum requirements for our participation have been included and appreciate that. We're not in the business of discriminating against handicapped students, so not particularly concerned about that. Don't now and won't in the future. Would draw your attention, however, to Section 19 on page 10, which is a contribution that I made to the bill, done in good faith, and in the order of an olive branch or a gesture of goodwill to my brethren and sistren in the educational community. Section 19 says that notwithstanding this act, any program, agreement, or plan in effect on the effective date of this act that provides access for public high school students to a post-secondary course is not affected by this act and may be continued or renewed at the discretion of the parties of the program, agreement, or plan. And in sub 2, it goes on to say that any new program, agreement, or plan that is developed after the effective date of this 2001 act and that intended to provide access for public high school students to a post-secondary course may be initiated at the discretion of a school district and a post-secondary institution. Sub 3 says, however, in neither case does that substitute for the standard option. Mr. Chairman and members, the thing that I want to say is that I've heard repeatedly in each of the hearings, and did again when you last had this bill up, concern about the impact on existing programs and how they're going to go away and the impact, and this will be the only thing we have. It is my hope that the bill is passed, becomes law, and Section 19 is included in it, that all those programs now in place and all those agreements which school districts and post-secondary institutions are engaged in now may remain. We encourage them to remain. We are here to tell you we will be willing partners in them. And any new programs which the parties in their creative minds and through their ingenuity wish to create may do so without having an effect on this program. But the announcement by February 1 has to go to the parents, as the bill requires. There is a 30-day window, I guess a 30 or 60-day window for the student to apply, and then the school district has to make this available to them so that you have the complete continuum of programs. And I say that for a particular reason. I know a lot about education in Oregon, but I have a lot of experience in Lane County. When you last met, you heard from a representative from Eugene District School J, where my son went and where I used to represent. But you didn't hear from Springfield or Bethel or West Fir or Oak Ridge. You didn't hear from Notai. You didn't hear from Blatchley Lane. You didn't hear from Crow Applegate Lorraine. You didn't hear from Florence or Junction City. You didn't hear from a lot of places where there was effectively no option, except for those options which the personnel in those school districts have been able to arrange on their own, and with either the community college or with the university. But I can tell you it is nothing compared to what is available in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford. And our interest is in having all those programs that people wish to support to be retained, but that we make available on a uniform platform to all students in the state, if we're going to do this, the same access that anybody else has, whether they're in District 4J or District 1 or not. And I think it's important that we include that. We have many programs now which the university system has in high schools at our expense. They will be continued. We're not going to give them up. There are many other options which are available to people. We're not going to give them up. Dual enrollments will continue. We like them. unified transcripts. We like them. They'll be continued. And I think Section 19 would be very helpful to signal to everyone that if your programs that you have now are so exciting, so worthwhile, so efficient, so effective, and you retain them, there may be no one in that high school who signs up for the extended option. On the other hand, if there's some place where there now are no options, at least under this bill, there would be one. So I want to thank all the members of the committee. This has been a very contentious little argument within the family. There's no doubt about that. I hope we're still friends when it's over, regardless of what you do. But I hope that you would do as the university system does, as it looks out over the United States of America, looking at other states who've done similar programs, willing partners, interested in students, dedicated to learner-paced achievement, can succeed. Now, I know there's money involved. The university system has a $96 million cut in its continuing service level budget. We want this bill. A model which you adopted 2 years ago, which funded the university system at 44% of the range of our peers, if that budget is adopted, would take us down to the 40th percentile of the range of our peers, and we want this bill. Our faculty are compensated 10% below, on average, the median of the range of our peers. We want this bill because we want students to achieve as appropriately as they can, directly when they can, to have options available to them, and to do so in a way that helps them. We stand ready to do that regardless of the outcome of our budget. I would hope that all other parties would be able to come forward and find a way to accomplish that too. And thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gridley.
Just a comment, if I may, to Mr. Cairns. I want to thank you. First of all, I really appreciate your use of the word contentious. In my 10-plus years around the Capitol, I think this is probably the most contentious effort I've ever been a part of, and so it's been a learning experience, certainly from where I sit. But I want to thank you. I want to thank you for offering constructive criticism. I want to thank you for coming forward with language for an amendment that strengthens and clarifies the bill. I want to thank you for bringing forth the olive branch. I'd like to know where the tree is, so that we can send a lot of folks on a field trip to get a branch, and at some point we can have a little party around that. But again, I just want to thank you for the constructive role that I believe you've played in all of this. Now, with that said, I do have a question for you, because this bill has been characterized as containing a policy that is going to allow just a group of well-to-do white students to move on from the high school setting to college. And I will say, first of all, that if I thought for a moment that this bill was going to serve only and prioritize the needs of well-to-do white students, if I can say it so directly, I wouldn't be on the bill. With that said, can you, from where you sit, can you reflect on that concern, that comment that keeps cropping up in this contentious discussion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I've heard that too. I think that there is a lot of anecdotal information which would lead people to believe that's the case. I think it's a decision at the district level and at the university level to decide how diligently they're going to work to make sure that the program succeeds, and whether they're going to work together to make it do so. I have to say, for the record, a person who comes forward, and the key issue for us has been the academic advising and assessment, if a person comes forward, regardless of what high school, what race or ethnicity, regardless of their background socioeconomically, if our assessment determines they're not going to benefit from it, then we're not going to accept them. But we have no a priori decision that says some people will be in and some people will be out. We plan on opening the doors and see who comes. We encourage all those who are academically prepared and can benefit from the experience. We're there to work with them and to see that they succeed. Now, beyond that, I can't say.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I will...
Senator Decker. Senator Decker, do you have a question?
I don't want to cut off Grattan mid. His mouth was open.
As always.
Not unusual.
His hand wasn't out.
Mr. Chairman, I have to say to Senator Decker, your stock just plummeted, pal. You were doing really good. But now he's going to finish.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cordley, I'm going to report your commendation to the people to whom it should be directed, and that would be Vice Chancellor Shirley Clark, Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs, and Holly Zanville, Associate Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs, to whom those accolades should go.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Grattan, you may not be the person, but it's related to the very good point that my friend from Portland made. I thought I had seen solid evidence, not anecdotal, that at least the experience that Minnesota had was that the students who are availing themselves of this program, and if you don't know this, I'll take it, but perhaps someone who's going to testify later would, that the students that were availing themselves of this program were, in many ways, fit the profile of I don't know if Ozzie's still here, Ozzie's son, that they tended to be relatively affluent and from communities that were relatively affluent, and those were the ones that Minnesota was reporting back of using the program.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Decker, it depends upon how the program is structured. In Minnesota, I think it was aimed from the beginning to do that end. On the other hand, in the state of Washington, the Running Start program was aimed at the other end of the spectrum and had a relationship only between school districts and community colleges. So, you could, depending on how you structure it, will certainly determine what the outcome is.
Mm-hmm.
This bill, as written, and I, like I say, I have no idea, you know, how it's going to turn out, casts the broadest net of any program like this. And the statute determines that the net will be cast as broadly as possible to all classes, including at risk and all others. So the outcome could be quite different and unlike those. So that's not all I can say.
So, Mr. Chair, so the Washington program was basically had a means testing or some sort of component in there that targeted it really at that target population. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, not to my knowledge, but I do believe it was targeted at community college. So it was students matriculating or actually getting a running start and doing so with the community college system. I believe, although I had no evidence, my understanding was that the legislature sitting in Olympia was to consider expanding it to the university. But I don't know whether they did that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Much. Chairman.
Thank you. Chris Smith, Amanda Rich, and Steve Johnson.
David Williams.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Special Education, Oregon Department of Education. I have some written testimony that's being shared with you, but I would like to just hit some of the highlights of my written testimony and raise some additional issues that became apparent upon reading the Dash 6 amendments. Senate Bill 783 is an exciting opportunity, and we believe that it will be even more exciting if we ensure that students with disabilities who are eligible have an equal opportunity to participate without any confusion or miscommunicated expectations. And therefore, we are very pleased with many of the amendments that are reflected in both the Dash 2 and the Dash 6 amendments. Special education for many years here in Oregon has worked cooperatively with post-secondary institutions to ensure that students with disabilities have an opportunity to be educated in an age-appropriate setting as we continue to educate students beyond the age of 18 in high schools. I've identified in my written testimony several examples of cooperative ventures between school districts and post-secondary school institutions. I won't speak to those, but I do want to raise a couple of concerns. One is our experience with charter schools leads me to be very pleased to see the Dash 6 amendments that talk about the written agreement between post-secondary institutions and school districts. It's very clear that the best intended outcomes for students, unless they're written down and unless there's a document that both parties, school districts and post-secondary institutions, can go to, that as programs progress, as issues come up which weren't anticipated, unless they can go to a contract or some kind of a written agreement, the student frequently is the one who is hurt in the situation. I must draw your attention to one concern that we have, that this will, as school districts are responsible for the special education services for a student with disabilities at a post-secondary institution, this will potentially increase the special ed costs for a district. They may find themselves having to duplicate special education services. I'll give you a couple of examples. One, in several of our school districts, students with hearing impairments who require sign language interpreters are provided those interpreters in two or three classes where students are grouped together. So one interpreter can serve the needs of several students at one time. If one of those students were to attend a post-secondary institution, the school district would be responsible for maintaining that sign language interpreter at the high school and then also employing and providing a second interpreter at the post-secondary institution. So that would be then an additional cost. Similar concerns would be raised for students who require the use of assistive technology. A student who may be chair-bound, who requires a voice synthesizer. If that assistive technology is maintained at the high school and kept there overnight, a second synthesizer might be required at the post-secondary institution, thus raising the cost for special education. I am concerned that the non-discrimination statement that was in Section 15 in the Dash 2 amendments is not reflected in the Dash 6 amendments. There are obviously other non-discrimination requirements that apply to post-secondary institutions, but it would be nice to see it explicitly stated in this bill. And finally, I would commit to you that the Department of Education, in its rulemaking around this, will do what it can to reduce paperwork by ensuring that the educational learning plan that's recommended in this bill for students with disabilities is reflected in their individualized education program, which already requires transition planning and transition services. We would see those two documents being one and the same for students with disabilities. Thank you.
Questions.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The non-discrimination statement has been mentioned a couple of times in testimony here. And just note, I would just note for the record that that's an inadvertent omission. It's our intent to have that language.
Senator Starr, Worley, thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, was there, or what is the department's position on financial caps to ensure that at least any shift or transfer of funds wouldn't be too overly onerous on our school budgets? And I guess I'm especially appreciative of this issue, just knowing that my school district right now is looking at a $8 million cut, how they factor that into the equation.
Senator Starr, Senator Deckert, I'm sorry, I really am not aware of the department's position on that specific issue. However, in a similar related issue, there is another concern I have in here, and the limitation of the number of years. Students with disabilities frequently may attend school beyond the age of 18, may spend more than 3 or 4 years in a secondary institution because of reduced vitality, health concerns. They may be seniors for several years. We have several students who could benefit from this program over a multiple-year period, more than 2 years. They may be denied access to this program for an extended period of time because of their disability.
Mr. Chair, I didn't read Office of Special Education. So you're not representing the Department of Education. You're just testifying specifically to the. I'm with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Williams, and I am here representing the Oregon School Employees Association. Let me first thank the chair and the committee for providing us this additional opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 783. OSEA is a union of more than 19,000 classified employees in Oregon's public K-12, ESD, Community College, Head Start, and Park and Recreation districts. The Oregon School Employees Association supports legislation that will improve educational opportunities for all students. However, I'm here today to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 783 and the proposed amendments. Senate Bill 783 is a voucher program. Let me say that again. Senate Bill 783 is a voucher program. It's a program that will allow students to take monies allocated to their high schools and use it to pay for college tuition. Senate Bill 783 is a solution searching for a problem. On my written testimony, you'll notice that I've bulleted four main points. I will go through those each individually. The first point, Senate Bill 783 would involuntarily require school districts to participate in this program, putting in jeopardy existing concurrent credits programs. High schools, many of which are facing increasingly tight budgets, have no choice in whether or not a student can leave the district, taking much-needed funding along with them. To require school districts to participate in this program ignores the unique circumstances of each individual district. Under Senate Bill 783, a student can even leave the local school district to take a course elsewhere, even when the district offers the identical course. OSEA cannot support any legislation or program that would force local high schools to give scarce dollars to colleges and universities regardless of the impact on the school. Roughly 22,000 students, or 25% of Oregon's juniors and seniors, a quarter of our juniors and seniors, are currently being served through concurrent credit programs all over the state. These programs have been designed and implemented by local districts in conjunction with local institutions of higher education. Senate Bill 783 is mandatory and may cause school districts to abandon existing programs in order to financially accommodate the proposed program. We've heard comments on Section 19, Subs 1 and 2 of the Dash 6 amendments, and I just want to additionally highlight Sub 3, which says that a program agreement or plan described in subsection 1 or 2 of this program may not be used as a substitute for the expanded options program. So even if you have a program in place and you say in the bill that it's not affected, legally it's not affected, it will be affected because this district has no choice on whether or not to implement Senate Bill 783. They are required to implement it, therefore taking away from the resources that they've allocated for other concurrent credit programs. My second point, Senate Bill 783 would strip scare scholars from the already tight budgets of Oregon's high schools. In 1991, the legislature passed the 21st Century Schools Reform Act, forcing broad and sweeping changes in Oregon's system of public schools. That legislation has caused the education community to dramatically change the way they educate children. The 21st Century Reform Act further made school districts highly accountable to these reforms. However, 10 years after the passage of this reform package, we still have not given school districts the financial resources to fully implement. To drain even more money from school districts through 783 moves us even further from our goal of high-quality education for all students. In addition, Senate Bill 783 shifts the burden for GED fulfillment from community colleges and other institutions onto the K-12 system. Oregon's K-12 system is designed and set up to make it possible for the youth of this state to obtain a high school diploma. Those who wish to bypass this system and obtain a GED have been provided with other avenues that they may pursue. However, the primary focus of Oregon's K-12 has always been and should remain the obtaining of a high school diploma. By forcing this policy on local schools, Senate Bill 783 changes these basic assumptions of our school system. Oregon's K-12 schools are not the only schools in the state facing budgetary constraints. Oregon's community colleges are also facing serious budget shortfalls and are presently having to turn away students who need further education. This bill would force them to refuse to admit even more students, either general public or students under this program, running contrary to their mission to serve all individuals who stand to benefit from their services. My third point, Senate Bill 783, would direct public dollars to private, religious, and non-religious institutions of higher education. The OSCA agrees with the opinion presented by Andrea Meyer of the ACLU of Oregon that this piece of legislation is unconstitutional in its violation of our separation of church and state. Senate Bill 783 would allow students to use their voucher dollars to attend any regionally accredited, not-for-profit institution of higher education. This means they could go to, as mentioned, George Fox, other schools, Mount Angel Seminary, Northwest Christian College, Warner Pacific College, Western Baptist College, or Western Seminary, among others. Just as the cost of educating students in K-12 includes more than just in-classroom costs, like building maintenance, administrator salaries, energy costs, etc., the cost of educating students in private religious institutions paid through tuition includes not only the professor in the classroom, but university administration, college-sanctioned and subsidized religious events, and the like. Oregon's Constitution states no money shall be drawn from the Treasury for the benefit of any religious or theological institution. I believe that this program flies in the face of that. Senate Bill 783 fails to effectively serve those at-risk students that it is purported to be designed for. It has been said that this program will help to better serve those students that are disenfranchised from our public education system. It is said that this program will help to better serve students at risk in Oregon's high schools. This program is supposed to be a solution for the problem of how to properly educate such students. Unfortunately, this solution is too much of a problem in itself. The fact is that this program will only serve those students who are engaged and involved in their own education. This program will fail to serve the students who are disconnected from their school. Senate Bill 783 will serve students who are currently being served through other programs that offer concurrent apprentice programs, like Oregon's 2+2 and other programs that we've heard testimony on in school districts around the state. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in conclusion, Senate Bill 783 creates a program that strips money involuntarily away from local school districts, allowing it to flow to private, sectarian and non-sectarian institutions of higher ed to serve students that are already being served through programs in the state. This legislation, and the amendments, undermines the education of Oregon's local K-12 districts and Oregon's children. None of these amendments address the current concerns that we have, and I would urge all of you to vote no on this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm representing the Oregon Community College Association today. With me today is Jerry Berger, president of Chemeketa Community College, and we're here today to do a couple of things. First, I'd like to go over the evolution of the OCCA position on this bill, and then I'd like to turn some time over to President Berger, if I may, to explain some of the OCCA concerns about this bill from Chemeketa's perspective. First off, though, I would like to thank Senator Gordley for involving the OCCA and many of our representatives from community colleges in the work groups on this bill. She has been extremely gracious in listening to all of our concerns. And I'd also like to mention her assistant, Karen Powell. Karen has spent much time with me in the office going over some of our community college concerns, and I very much appreciate that. Oregon's community colleges support early college opportunities for high school students. Our 17 colleges, each of our 17 colleges is involved in early college programs, and we serve, of those 22,000 students that you heard about earlier, we serve a vast portion of those. In fact, at Portland Community College alone, I think you heard last time that 6,000 students are served through early college programs. That said, when our board first reviewed this legislation, we took a neutral position on the bill because many of the members of our board, they do represent individual colleges, and they had extremely unique and individual positions on this bill. They were vastly different opinions, and so we chose to take a neutral position. But we stayed involved to try to protect community college interests, because this bill does have quite a large impact on community colleges. Many of the students that would be participating in this program will go to community colleges under this program. When the Dash 1 amendments came out, the bill had changed dramatically enough that we decided to revisit our position. And at that time, we went to a position of opposition. And so I suppose you could say we are opposed to the bill in its current form, although no Dash 1s have been adopted. I know they were the ones that were being most seriously considered. And so we had some very serious concerns with the Dash 1 amendment. And we have worked to develop many of the changes that you see in the Dash 6 amendments. And so later on, if you would like, I will go through and explain some of the changes that we have asked for on the Dash 6 amendment. But at this time, I would like to turn the mic over to President Berger and to have him explain some of the background of where community colleges are coming from as we look at this bill and as we discuss this bill.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jerry Berger, president of Chemeketa Community College. It's just a little background. Chemeketa serves Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County and a little part of Linn County. And last academic year, we served over 51,000 students. I'd like to take my remarks and divide it into three areas. Number one, I'd start with that Chemeketa has a wonderful relationship with our 21 school districts in our area and participate with hundreds of students in our 2+2 program and in our Step Ahead program. It's successful. We have faculty working with faculty, and the transition both to our institution and to university systems throughout the state and the country work extremely well. So our current programs do open a lot of doors for high school students. The major community college concern, and maybe concern may not be the word, but the challenge, is that I believe it affects all 17 community colleges, is one of capacity. I know at Chemeketa we are full. We have waiting lists for GED programs, ESL, and a lot of our lower division programs are full. Nursing programs are professional, technical. We have a capacity challenge. Unlike the independent and the public university systems, community colleges serve from basic literacy which is a challenge for our K through 12 system at the kindergarten level, et cetera, to high-tech industry. So when we deal with this possible bill, we have challenges of other capacity, and how do we refuse or not cooperate and give people options of attending or not attending? Obviously, our board does set policy, and obviously we would probably give the advantage to our adult population that have no other way to get training, no other way to get education. But it does provide us some interesting challenges with the capacity and what this might occur. Capacity does revolve around funding. I know that you realize that the Oregon Community Colleges are attempting to get funded for enrollments we presently are generating, let alone funding for new enrollments that we are not presently generating. So the funding and the capacity issues are very challenging for the community colleges. We are open-door institutions, and we do pride ourselves on taking students who want to attend the community colleges of where they are so they can get where they want to be. One outstanding program we have at Chemeketa, we have an alternative program through which the local school districts fund that program. It is at capacity. We do have a waiting list for that also. So I think the funding issue, the capacity issue would bring us some challenges regarding the results of this legislation. Thank you for letting me address the committee.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Senator Starr,
yes.
If I may, would the committee be interested in hearing some of the changes that we asked for in the Dash 6 amendments? I think that the written testimony I submitted may go over those well enough. I just didn't know if there were any questions from that perspective.
We might.
Okay. And then just additionally, there's one more piece of paper that you have in front of you. When we were here before, Senator Gordley specifically asked to hear some comments from Oregon Coast Community College and Portland Community College about how they had fears about how this program would affect their college. In front of you is a letter from Oregon Coast Community College, and Portland's letter will be forthcoming.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Just briefly to Ms. Rich, thank you very much for the way in which you have worked so constructively with our office, and you mentioned Karen Powell, working closely with Karen, and particularly for offering up suggested language for the amendments. Your efforts have helped us to strengthen the bill. And again, my comment is one about the way in which you have constructively engaged our office. We appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Miguel Salinas. Mr. Salinas, you wish to testify? All right. I believe that's the end of our testimony.
Mr. Flores.
Hybrid marked by your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Merced Flores, Associate Superintendent for the Office of Student Services at the Department of Education. I have before you some testimony that I've been waiting to provide, and I do have copies for you. We would like to say that the goal of this work is to continue to expand learning options for all students to increase personal and academic student success. It's our intention that this legislation will support student success to post-secondary experiences while not weakening the capacity of high school students to serve other students. Currently, we have about 22,000 high school students of the 80,000 juniors and seniors that are receiving dual credit by participating in post-secondary education tech credit or academic credit programs. If you were to compare us with other states, for example, Minnesota has 7,100 students of their 110,000 juniors and seniors in their post-secondary programs, and Washington State has 13,000 students participating in their 142,000 juniors and seniors programs, this program called Running Start. So by far, we have quite a few students already participating in a dual language program, dual credit program, and that's 22,000 students of the 80,000 juniors and seniors. We want to build on this foundation by providing post-secondary education options for students. The following criteria are important to be included in this bill to fulfill the promise that we have for our students. We want to emphasize that this bill is not meant to replace current agreements between schools and post-secondary institutions, and that districts and institutions can either enter into agreements that are outside the parameters of this bill. We also want to show that where agreements already exist between school districts and post-secondary institutions, these provisions do not apply, but the school districts must offer expanded options to all students. We want to also emphasize and prioritize that minority and at-risk students and their parents be notified when students have dropped out of school, and I believe this language has been part of the Dash 6 amendment. But we also have concerns about the clarity regarding the actual instructional cost to be charged for non-tuition and non-credit courses. I believe that's on page 7 of the Dash 6 amendment. So I believe that's the part that we have concern about. Mr. Chair, I know Senator Decker had asked a question about the cap. We support the cap that is included in the language of this bill. Other questions? Thank you.
Other questions?
Where's the cap in the Dash 6, Mr. Chair?
On page 6 and 7.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Decker.
Mr. Flores, and thank you. I appreciate the test. So, line 23 through line 30 are the cap portion?
Right.
Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, it is.
Can you walk me through that just briefly, what that achieves for us in terms of limiting the number of students that would participate in the program beyond, I guess it's beyond the 22,000.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, if I could ask two members of our staff to come up and explain that piece of it, if that would be okay. We had done an analysis of this bill, and also we did a fiscal impact that involved a cap, and we want to make sure that we answer your question correctly.
For the record, Senator Starr and members of the committee, Greg Harpole, Office of Professional Technical Education, Department of Ed. The cap I think that you're looking for is actually on page 10. If you will notice on page 10, beginning on line line 12 is the beginning of that discussion, where the cap itself is based on an enrollment of 1,000 student school that would be 330 quarter credits or 200 semester credits would be the maximum cap. And then that goes on to identify then that the State Board of Education would have responsibility for using those same proportions to deal with the remainder of that for larger and for smaller schools.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, and thank you. That's helpful. So how many students, just I'm trying to do the quick math on that, 330 out of 1,000, do you know roughly how many students that equivocates or equivocates to?
Senator Deckard, one of the difficulties that we've got into as we've worked with this is not knowing the number of credits that individual students would actually be taking. So, in essence, if you were to look at an average college class of approximately 3 credits, then that 330 credits would, you know, amount to about 100 students for that 1,000 student high school over the course of a year. So, you know, thinking of that on a semester basis, you'd have approximately 50 students that would be involved for that 1,000 student high school.
Hmm. So, it's, Mr. Chair, it's fair to say roughly 50 out of 1,000, which is about 5%. Is that a fair? I mean, and I wouldn't hold you. It's just a rough number. So about 5% of a school, small or large.
Right. Senator Deckard, yes, it's going to be in that neighborhood. The thing to keep in mind is that as the bill is written, it would be 11th and 12th grade students or those over the age of 16. So in essence, who you're actually looking at would be approximately half of the student body. So the percentage actually of the students that would be able to participate would be actually above the 5%.
It would be.
Right, it would be. If think about it this way, if you were to consider that approximately 500 students in 1,000 student high school, in essence, would be eligible because they're juniors and seniors, and of those, there would be 330 credits split amongst those students, in essence, is the way that would break out.
And Mr. Chair, just one other question. How does this represent the other, I mean, we've heard, I guess, several times today, 22,000 students are already in some ways participating in a program like this. How does this factor in those 22,000 students? Is this on top of that, would these 5%? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I believe it would be, with the 22,000 students we're talking about, these students would not be affected by this this bill. We would hope that the students or school districts that have already agreements that we'd stay, let those agreements stay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
For Mr. Flores, I did want a little clarity. You talked about you're concerned about the clarity of charges, and I wasn't quite clear what you were talking about in the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, on page...
Is that 7, where that we talk about the...
Yeah, this is on page 7.
Okay.
Line 14 says that where it starts out, that a non-tuition course or non-credit course pursuant to Section 3 of the 2001 Act for the payment of actual instructional costs associated with the student attending the eligible post-secondary course at the institution. We're not sure if this means tuition plus other costs, and who determines or who defines that cost. Is there a cost recovery associated with that? So it's new language in this Dash 6 amendment that we're not really sure about. And because in some previous language, I believe in the first, the actual bill, it did talk about some cost, but when they're talking about actual cost, does that mean tuition plus any other cost associated with that? So it's not very clear if it would even mean more money beyond what is being reimbursed. And Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, Greg Hartpole might be able to answer more information about that because he's done an analysis of that.
Senator Starr, Senator Castillo, the concern as we looked at this is as you read the previous sections of the bill relating to the tuition and books and other costs, those are published amounts. it's clear as to what those are, and so you know what to expect. The concern there was the actual instructional costs seems to leave that quite open as to what that would be. And from a put yourself in the place of a secondary school who has a student who decides that they want to go to the local community college to receive whatever that kind of training might be. They're accepted by that local community college. Once they're accepted, then the local secondary school has no choice as to what the cost is going to be that they're going to pay, because they were, in essence, accepted up to the cap. So the concern was that while if you're dealing with credit, that you have a certain number of dollars per credit that is expected. In this case, there's no such indicator at all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just still bit on my numbers and I can't get it out of my head. So if I'm a small school, I've got 50 students in 11th and 12th grade, how many students could I possibly lose if I'm one of the smaller schools in Oregon under, if we adopted the Dash 6, how many students could I possibly lose under the Dash 6 of those if I've got 50?
Senator Starr, Senator Deckard, I don't have that information here with me today, but we have done a run that would identify the amount that this would be per school, and we could certainly check that and get back to you with that.
Yeah.
I think help is on the way here.
Senator Starr, members of the committee, my name is Ron Dexter. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Professional Technical Department at the Oregon Department of Education. I thought I might just provide a little bit more clarity on the cap that might help you understand the answer to that question.
Okay.
The cap was determined using 1,000 student high school grades 9 through 12 on the 330 quarter hours were used as a target for approximately a half-time teacher loss for 1,000 student high school. 0.5 FTE loss would be the maximum loss. Now, if you go to Westview High School, which has over 2,000, you're talking about the loss of a full-time teacher in terms of basic school support.
One teacher.
So it's proportional to the size of the high school. So if you're talking 50, you're talking 1/20 of, or 5% of $32,000. Which I believe would be in my head, I'm coming up with $1,600. I don't know if that math is right, but I think it is. 5% of $32,000. Yeah, I think that's correct. So that gives you an idea. That gives you an idea of, it's all based on a proportion of your enrollment. And primarily, working with the governor's office, we determined that that was an amount that would not significantly erode the school budget. Now, but I want to make a point and have the committee understand that when you take a full-time teacher out of a large high school like Westview, you are eliminating, if the decision is to take it from staffing, which in most cases it would be, you're talking about eliminating 5 periods of instruction out of that master schedule, which means 150 students no longer have the opportunity to take classes that were currently offered in that schedule before. And if you're talking of a high school of 50, you're talking about taking $1,600 out of that high school budget that they are going to somewhere have to make cuts. Now, they might not make it in staffing, might be in supplies, or they might lose an instructional aide. But anyway, that may help understand the financial impact depending on the size of the district. Does that help?
No, that's very helpful. I think the runs would be, Mr. Chair, also very, very helpful just to understand. I mean, your testimony right there to me was more illustrative of what it would do, obviously, to larger districts like mine, Beaverton and Tigard, but also to ones that I have such much less familiarity with, those smaller districts where I would think $1,600 So it is just a drop in the bucket at obviously a large school district. I would think that would be a significant undertaking to cut that out of a 32-student budget.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
Yeah, I'd like to request that if you could provide that information to the committee, that would be great to show us the financial impact.
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, we have that information per high school, exactly what the cost would be. It was easy calculation because we know all of the enrollments and we just did a proportion for each of the schools. So we have that data.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Castillo.
Thank you. And that's an estimate under the cap that's being proposed. And then on page 10, I think it's line 28, section 18, it repeals the cap in 2005. So is there a way of estimating? I guess you can't estimate what the impact would be if there is no cap and it's just there isn't a limit.
Senator Starr, or Chairman Starr, and Senator Castillo. Another piece of information that has not been shared in these hearings is that in the state of Minnesota, in 1 year, in the year 2000. High schools lost $17.5 million in basic school support in 1 year. And to answer Senator Deckard's earlier question about the Running Start program in Washington, that program is very much designed for college-bound students, and you have to pass the asset test to qualify. And the only students that can pass that test are the students that can pass first year college math and first year writing at the college level. And those are the only students that are eligible to participate in the Running Start program in Washington.
And Mr. Chair, on the Running Start program in Washington, is there some sort of, the prior testimony was that there was some way of ensuring that it really was targeted at those students that fit the criteria of low or moderate income? Is that not factors?
That's not the information that I obtained when I called the Superintendent of Public Instruction's office at the state of Washington. There may be some other data, but I talked to the person in charge, Brian Jeffries, in charge of the Running Start program, and students there do not have to go through their counselor. They can go directly to the college, and if they pass the test, they qualify.
Mr. Chair, do you have... I think I've seen it, the information on the Minnesota program of which students are availing themselves of the program. Do you have the, and I now know this term, the disaggregated data, which I have learned in this committee?
Chairman Starr and Senator Deckard, we have some information on that. Minnesota has published about a half-inch thick booklet on all of their data. There's been audits and so forth, so we have that. What I recall seeing is a chart that showed that 65% of the students participating in the Minnesota program came from median or higher income families, 65%. And I also asked the question, does this work in Minnesota for at-risk youth? And the student said, or the person in charge of the program said, how could it? When you have to be in Minnesota to qualify, you have to be in the top 50% of your class academically as a junior. No, I'm sorry, the top 33% of your class as a junior academically. And as a senior, you have to be in the top 50% of your class. So his point was, how could it apply to at-risk youth? And in fact, he said they tried, some principals tried sending borderline students that weren't making it in high school into the program, and they were not successful in most cases. Now, there are some situations where some at-risk youth were successful, but primarily they were not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
What's that figure again on how much the schools lost the first year of the Minnesota program?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What was the figure again on how much the Minnesota schools lost the first...
$17.5 million in the year 2000.
Mr. Chairman.
And I might add, Mr. Chairman and Senator Castillo,
that did not include an additional factor of 0.32 times a waiting FTE factor at community college that the community college is receiving in Minnesota for the what they call a post-secondary expanded options program. So there's another factor that community colleges receive in addition to the tuition they receive on top of the tuition.
Mr. Fisher?
Yeah. What's the population in Minnesota, and what does that other factor that they pay the community college have to do with this matter?
All right. Chairman Starr, Senator Fisher, in Minnesota, the average enrollment in one grade is about 67,000 students, and in Oregon it's about 40, so they are a larger state.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Castillo.
But they have fewer students in the program than we do, right? Don't we have over 20,000 and they have 7,000 plus? Is that right?
Those, I believe those are full-time equivalent students in the state of Washington.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sorry, Minnesota.
Minnesota.
7,000. I believe those are full-time equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And the 22,000 in, is that 13? Yeah, for a total of. Yeah, in Oregon, the 22,000 are part-time students that might be receiving 3 to 9 credits in a year.
So it's different. All right.
Yeah. Senator Fisher?
You only answered part of my question. The other part of my question was, what did that 3.2 or whatever it was deal that was paid to the community colleges have to do with this bill? We're not proposing anything like
no,
that.
No, Senator, Chairman Starr, Senator Fisher, it's just additional information for you in terms of how the Minnesota plan works. That's all.
Thank you very much. If there's no further questions, appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Michael Rose, would you like to come forward?
I'm Michael Rose, and I'm on the board at Lane Community College. My wife here, Nancy, is an ex-school teacher from Eugene, and she's actually going to give you the testimony, and I'll answer questions if they come up.
And between us, we have 68 years of teaching, so we know something about education. I have four areas that I'd like to talk to you about, and I'll make this quick because I want you to know how much I appreciate your staying and taking the time to listen. But before I do that, I'm sorry Grattan Cairns, my former senator, isn't in the room because he needs to spend a little more time down in Eugene looking at the schools. It isn't just the Eugene School District that has programs he talked about. And yes, his students did get a good education. I want you to know we in Eugene know that our students get a good education, but so do the students in Junction City. They have AP classes and they have City College, as do Springfield, as does Bethel, as does Pleasant Hill, as does Cottage Grove, and a number of other areas in Eugene, and I'm sure that's true throughout the state. So enough said on that. If you can pass that on, or I'll pass it on myself. The four areas I want to talk to you about that I am most concerned about would be capacity, eligibility, accountability, and unfunded mandates. And you have a sheet on this and you can read it. I'm going to just add a few little things. But until the legislature, and I know it's not your fault, but until the legislature chooses to fund current services sufficiently, we both oppose providing additional services. Community colleges need $76 million. That's what they've had. Not the $45 million that is currently in the governor's proposed budget. For example, Lane Community College will be reducing its budget, even with the governor's proposed budget. Community colleges can't raise tuition and remain accessible. In other words, affordable to the kinds of students they serve. Well, I don't think any college can. The emergency board's additional funds for this past year are not recurring. So we will be unable to serve the same numbers without legislative support, let alone new high school students. And Lane has some other priorities, as do all community colleges, and I think one of the highest priorities they have is displaced workers, and I think they have to come before high school students at this point. Eligibility. Senate Bill 783 does not require a proven record of success and completion of work at the high school level. Colleges and universities would be required to accept students who have not shown the ability or maturity necessary to succeed in a higher education setting. Prior to eligibility for college, work paid for by the state and any expanded options bill should require satisfactory completion and progress in high school. And I know that you're addressing special education students. The records on that would then extend to college. That's already there. There would be more of that, and it is just one more added burden. Colleges already serve disabled students, and that's at a greater cost to colleges, and this bill would provide it to be at an even greater cost. And accountability is something else that is now done in K-12 that would not be carried through, as far as I can tell, in this bill at the college level. Because college funding is not dependent on daily attendance records as it is in K-12, it seems contrary to the state's interest in educational accountability to design a program that prepays student tuition for college courses without any mechanism to ensure that students attend classes and pass them. And as a high school teacher, I guarantee that you need to have that mechanism in there to make sure that students are attending. And we don't get paid for students at the high school level if they're not in class. And that would not be true under this bill. The colleges would be paid whether those students were in class or not. Last, unfunded mandates, and we all know that this has been going on at the legislature for some time. Senate Bill 783 provides some students with college scholarships at the expense of K-12 programs. The tuition does not cover the college's expenses, and thus the enacting of this legislation would represent unfunded mandates. Given education's current budget and inadequate state funding, public education systems will not be able to fulfill the legislative intent of this bill should it become law. And we urge you to oppose this, and thank you very much for staying this late in the day and hearing us. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Thank you very much. We're going to take a 5-minute recess. We'll be back here. We've got two additional bills to hear. And we intend to hear those yet today. So we're going to be in recess for 5 minutes.